Supreme Court of the United States, Clinton versus Jones, May 27, 1997. Justice Stevens delivered the opinion of the court. This case raises a constitutional and a prudential question concerning the office of the President of the United States. Respondent, the private citizen, seeks to recover damages from the current occupant of that office based on actions allegedly taken before his term began. The President submits that, in all but the most exceptional cases, the Constitution requires federal courts to defer such litigation until his term ends, and that, in any event, respect for the office warrants such a stay. Despite the force of the arguments supporting the President's submissions, we conclude that they must be rejected. Petitioner William Jefferson Clinton was elected to the presidency in 1992 and re-elected in 1996. His term of office expires on January 20, 2001. In 1991, he was the governor of the state of Arkansas. Respondent Paula Corbin Jones is a resident of California. In 1991, she lived in Arkansas and was an employee of the Arkansas Industrial Development Commission. On May 6, 1994, she commenced this action in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Arkansas by filing a complaint naming petitioner and Danny Ferguson, a former Arkansas State Police officer, as defendants. The complaint alleges two federal claims and two state law claims over which the federal court has jurisdiction because of the diverse citizenship of the parties. As the case comes to us, we are required to assume the truth of the detailed but as yet untested factual allegations in the complaint. Those allegations principally describe events that are said to have occurred on the afternoon of May 8, 1991, during an official conference held at the Excelsior Hotel in Little Rock, Arkansas. The governor delivered a speech at the conference. Respondent, working as a state employee, staffed the registration desk. She alleges that Ferguson persuaded her to leave her desk and to visit the governor in a business suite at the hotel, where he made abhorrent sexual advances that she vehemently rejected. She further claims that her superiors at work subsequently dealt with her in a hostile and rude manner and changed her duties to punish her for rejecting those advances. Finally, she alleges that after petitioner was elected president, Ferguson defamed her by making a statement to a reporter that implied she had accepted petitioner's alleged overtures, and that various persons authorized to speak for the president publicly branded her a liar by denying that the incident had occurred. Respondent seeks actual damages of $75,000 and punitive damages of $100,000. Her complaint contains four counts. The first charges that petitioner, acting under color of state law, deprived her of rights protected by the Constitution in violation of 42 U.S.C. Section 1983. The second charges that petitioner and Ferguson engaged in a conspiracy to violate her federal rights, also actionable under federal law. The third is a state common law claim for intentional infliction of emotional distress, grounded primarily on the incident at the hotel. The fourth count, also based on state law, is for defamation, embracing both the comments allegedly made to the press by Ferguson and the statements of petitioner's agents. Inasmuch as the legal sufficiency of the claims has not yet been challenged, we assume without deciding that each of the four counts states a cause of action as a matter of law. With the exception of the last charge, which arguably may involve conduct within the outer perimeter of the president's official responsibilities, it is perfectly clear that the alleged misconduct of petitioner was unrelated to any of his official duties as President of the United States and, indeed, occurred before he was elected to that office. In response to the complaint, petitioner promptly advised the district court that he intended to file a motion to dismiss on the grounds of presidential immunity and requested the court to defer all other pleadings and motions until after the immunity issue was resolved. Relying on our cases holding that immunity questions should be decided at the earliest possible stage of the litigation, our recognition of the singular importance of the president's duties, and the fact that the question did not require any analysis of the allegations of the complaint, the court granted the request. Petitioner thereupon filed a motion to dismiss without prejudice and to toll any statutes of limitation that may be applicable until he is no longer president, at which time the plaintiff may refile the instant suit. Extensive submissions were made to the district court by the parties and the Department of Justice. The district judge denied the motion to dismiss on immunity grounds and ruled that discovery in the case could go forward. but ordered any trial stays until the end of petitioner's presidency. Although she recognized that a thin majority in Nixon versus Fitzgerald had held that the president has absolute immunity from civil damage actions arising out of the execution of official duties of office, she was not convinced that a president has absolute immunity from civil causes of action arising prior to assuming the office. She was, however, persuaded by some of the reasoning in our opinion in Fitzgerald that deferring the trial if one were required would be appropriate. Relying in part on the fact that respondent had failed to bring her complaint until 2 days before the 3-year period of limitations expired, she concluded that the public interest in avoiding litigation that might hamper the president in conducting the duties of his office outweighed any demonstrated need for an immediate trial. Both parties appealed. A divided panel of the Court of Appeals affirmed the denial of the motion to dismiss, but because it regarded the order postponing the trial until the president leaves office as the functional equivalent of a grant of temporary immunity, it reversed that order. Writing for the majority, Judge Bauman explained that the president, like all other government officials, is subject to the same laws that apply to all other members of our society, that he could find no case in which any public official ever has been granted any immunity from suit for his unofficial acts, and that the rationale for official immunity is inapposite where only personal private conduct by a president is at issue. The majority specifically rejected the argument that unless immunity is available, the threat of judicial interference with the executive branch through scheduling orders, potential contempt citations, and sanctions would violate separation of powers principles. Judge Bauman suggested that judicial case management sensitive to the burdens of the presidency and the demands of the president's schedule would avoid the perceived danger. In dissent, Judge Ross submitted that even though the holding in Fitzgerald involved official acts, the logic of the opinion, which placed primary reliance on the prospect that the president's discharge of his constitutional powers and duties would be impaired if he were subject to suits for damages, applies with equal force to this case. In his view, unless exigent circumstances can be shown, all private actions for damages against a sitting president must be stayed until the completion of his term. In this case, Judge Ross saw no reason why the stay would prevent respondent from ultimately obtaining an adjudication of her claims. In response to the dissent, Judge Beam wrote a separate concurrence. He suggested that a prolonged delay may well create a significant risk of irreparable harm to respondent because of an unforeseeable loss of evidence or the possible death of a party. Moreover, he argued that in civil rights cases brought under Section 1983, there is a public interest in an ordinary citizen's timely vindication of her most fundamental rights against alleged abusive power by government officials. In his view, the dissent's concern about judicial interference with the functioning of the presidency was greatly overstated. Neither the involvement of prior presidents in litigation, either as parties or as witnesses, nor the character of this relatively uncomplicated civil litigation indicated that the threat was serious. Finally, he saw no basis for staying discovery or trial of the claims against Trooper Ferguson. The president, represented by private counsel, filed a petition for certiorari. The Solicitor General, representing the United States, supported the petition, arguing that the decision of the Court of Appeals was fundamentally mistaken and created serious risks for the institution of the presidency. In her brief in opposition to certiorari, respondent argued that this one-of-a-kind case is singularly inappropriate for the exercise of our certiorari jurisdiction because it did not create any conflict among the courts of appeals, it does not pose any conceivable threat to the functioning of the executive branch, and there is no precedent supporting the president's position. While our decision to grant the petition expressed no judgment concerning the merits of the case, it does reflect our appraisal of its importance. The representations made on behalf of the executive branch as to the potential impact of the precedent established by the Court of Appeals merit our respectful and deliberate consideration. It is true that we have often stressed the importance of avoiding the premature adjudication of constitutional questions. That doctrine of avoidance, however, is applicable to the entire federal judiciary, not just to this court, and comes into play after the court has acquired jurisdiction of a case. It does not dictate a discretionary denial of every certiorari petition raising a novel constitutional question. It does, however, make it appropriate to identify two important constitutional issues not encompassed within the questions presented by the petition for certiorari that we need not address today. First, because the claim of immunity is asserted in federal court and relies heavily on the doctrine of separation of powers that restrains each of the three branches of the federal government from encroaching on the domain of the other two, it is not necessary to consider or decide whether a comparable claim might succeed in a state tribunal. If this case were being heard in a state forum, instead of advancing a separation of powers argument, petitioner would presumably rely on federalism and comity concerns, as well as the interest in protecting federal officials from possible local prejudice that underlies the authority to remove certain cases brought against federal officers from a state to a federal court. Whether those concerns would present a more compelling case for immunity is a question that is not before us. Second, our decision rejecting the immunity claim and allowing the case to proceed does not require us to confront the question whether a court may compel the attendance of the president at any specific time or place. We assume that the testimony of the president, both for discovery and for use at trial, may be taken at the White House at a time that will accommodate his busy schedule, and that if a trial is held, there would be no necessity for the president to attend in person, though he could elect to do so. Petitioner's principal submission that in all but the most exceptional cases, the Constitution affords the president temporary immunity from civil damages litigation arising out of events that occurred before he took office cannot be sustained on the basis of precedent. Only three sitting presidents have been defendants in civil litigation involving their actions prior to taking office. Complaints against Theodore Roosevelt and Harry Truman had been dismissed before they took office. The dismissals were affirmed after their respective inaugurations. Two companion cases arising out of an automobile accident were filed against John F. Kennedy in 1960 during the presidential campaign. After taking office, he unsuccessfully argued that his status as commander-in-chief gave him a right to a stay under the Soldiers and Sailors Civil Relief Act of 1940. The motion for a stay was denied by the district court and the matter was settled out of court. Thus, none of those cases sheds any light on the constitutional issue before us. The principal rationale for affording certain public servants immunity from suits for money damages arising out of their official acts is inapplicable to unofficial conduct. In cases involving prosecutors, legislatures, and judges, we have repeatedly explained that the immunity serves the public interest in enabling such officials to perform their designated functions effectively without fear that a particular decision may give rise to personal liability. As we explained in Ferry versus Ackerman, as public servants, the prosecutor and the judge represent the interest of society as a whole. The conduct of their official duties may adversely affect a wide variety of different individuals, each of whom may be a potential source of future controversy. The societal interest in providing such public officials with the maximum ability to deal fearlessly and impartially with the public at large has long been recognized as an acceptable justification for official immunity. The point of immunity for such officials is to forestall an atmosphere of intimidation that would conflict with their resolve to perform their designated functions in a principled fashion. That rationale provided the principal basis for our holding that a former president of the United States was entitled to absolute immunity from damages liability predicated on his official acts. Our central concern was to avoid rendering the president unduly cautious in the discharge of his official duties. This reasoning provides no support for an immunity for unofficial conduct. As we explained in Fitzgerald, the sphere of protected action must be related closely to the immunity's justifying purposes. Because of the president's broad responsibilities, we recognized in that case an immunity from damages claims arising out of official acts extending to the outer perimeter of his authority. But we have never suggested that the president or any other official has an immunity that extends beyond the scope of any action taken in an official capacity.